Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hello and welcome to Humans of Excess Manchester with me, Clint Boone. Every week we celebrate the spirit of Manchester by speaking to somebody who's had an influence on the city. This week I'm joined by a star of stage and screen, most notably for her role as Hayley Cropper in Coronation Street, Julie Hesmond-Alsh. She's going to tell us about the first music she fell in love with.
The Smiths became a real massive, massive part of my life. Yeah. I mean, it became a total soundtrack to my teenage years in that little bedroom.
And she'll also explain the impact getting the role of Hayley had on her life.
When I got it, I was absolutely thrilled. It was a dream come true. And I had absolutely no fear about feeling that I was the person who could represent this group of people.
It gives me great pleasure to welcome to Humans of Excess Manchester an actress who first came to the attention of most of the British TV viewers as the first ever transgender character in a British TV series. She's gone on to play key parts in other amazing productions, including Happy Valley and Cucumber and Broadchurch. It's a massive list. Julie Hesmond-Alsh, welcome to Humans of Excess Manchester.
Thanks, Clint. Nice.
Is that the way to pronounce it, Hesmond-Alsh?
That was really, really good, actually.
Is that good effort?
Yeah, yeah.
Right, okay.
Yeah, it's great. I don't know why everyone struggles with it so much. It's like Green-Alsh. Yeah. You know what I mean? It's like there's an SH on end. Everyone calls me Julie Hes, and I just...
Julie Hes. I like that. The Hes. Do you think you'll ever become the Hes?
I am the Hes. In some quarters, I am known as La Hes sometimes. I don't know. I can live with that.
I'm known as the Boone in my house.
I like it.
They have to address me as the Boone. Let's go back to the beginning, Julie. I mean, we all know that you are a Lancashire girl through and through. Tell us where you were born and when.
So I was born in Church in Accrington, which is next to the better known Ozzel Twistle, to John and Maureen, who were office workers who did a pools round on a Thursday night, with a big brother, Dave, who's 7 years older than me. So I grew up there, lived there all my life until I was 18 and went away to London to go to drama school, which was a bit of a culture shock after, because I hadn't even really experienced Manchester. You know, my place was the La-Di-Da's in Accrington, which was this kind of like amazing sort of place where the stars of Brookside would come on Thursday night to sign autographs. It was alternative night in this cocktail bar overlooking the slums of Accrington with like plastic palm trees. It's like Brave New World or something. It was an amazing place. And so I never went to Hacienda because I was too busy, Yeah, shimmying around dance floor at the La-di-da's and then went to London and became lost for 10 years. So I managed to miss the coolest period in Manc musical history completely.
Yeah, well, I've got some photographs I can show you, some tales I can tell you.
Thank you. Well, I do sometimes bullshit that I was there, do you know what I mean? Because I know enough about it now. So
tell us about, you used a phrase there which I recognise. I'm always fascinated when occasionally get reminded of things that have gone by. Doing the pools round, explain that to people that might not know that.
Yeah, not everyone would know, would they? No. So the football coupons or the pools was something. It was like that would be delivered to your door once a week, and you'd give a little bit of money. It's gambling basically, and you'd bet on the fixtures, the football fixtures for that week. Yeah. But there was also spot the ball, which was the best thing ever.
That was amazing.
Where you'd have a still from a match, and you had to guess exactly where the ball was in this still and draw it on.
The Oldham Chronicle used to do that every week, and it'd be a black and white picture. And back then, they black and white pictures in newspapers, all dots on it. Yeah. You had to guess where the ball was and post it off. And if you got near it, you won some money, didn't you?
Yeah,
spot the ball.
Absolutely, yeah. So that was on my Thursday nights with mum and dad, with like this like cover over at table in the living room with like all the money and the pools. And while I watched Top at Pops, Fame. Yeah. And disaster movies.
Brothers and sisters? You got siblings?
Yeah, so Dave is my older brother. So he's 7 years older than me. Yeah. And he's a professor of media studies at Leeds University now. Boy, done good. So he was a massive influence on my life because he was old enough to be right in the punk era. So his influence on me musically, and that's his area of interest as well. He's written books on cultural significance of music and what it means to communities, and especially what it means to like working class people then and now. So he had a huge influence on me that I was like way, way less cool than him. I remember getting bollocks off my dad for having a copy, never mind the bollocks. That's one of my first cultural memories of our house. My dad going mad because of it, where I was still listening to Grease soundtrack at that point. You know.
So he's Dave Esmondalsh. Will I be able to get his book online or whatever?
Oh, yeah, he's got quite a few, but they're kind of academic tomes, really. There's one called Why Music Matters, which is absolutely brilliant. Yeah.
You should get him into one of these.
He's brilliant. Yeah. He's absolutely brilliant. Yeah, he's a fascinating bloke.
So it sounds like it was an happy childhood.
It really, really was, yeah. Yeah,
proper I
was
working class.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And really, really loving ace parents who, as well as giving us a really stable and happy childhood, also really gave us the freedom to do whatever we wanted to do, which, you know, I really value. Now I'm a mum, I see how hard that is, you know, because all my dad ever wanted for us was for us both to work at a building society in Accrington. That would have made his life. And Dave went off. He ended up getting a scholarship to Oxford and being a professor. And I ended up like going to drama school and then going being in Coronation Street. And he's a bit like, what have we bred? What have we bred more? But they were so proud of us. And also, you know, I always have to give a massive, massive credit because they brought us up. They're not political people, my mum and dad, at all in terms of like wearing it on their sleeves. I think they both always like say that they were socialists, Labour voters or whatever, but they brought us up with a real sense of right and wrong and about accepting people for what they were. And in the 70s and 80s in Accrington, there was quite a lot of racial division.
Really?
Yeah, they were, you know, and there were pubs that, you know, were right-wing pubs and left-wing pubs, and there was a lot of racism. And my mum and dad wouldn't have any of that and brought us up from the word go, knowing that that wasn't right, which is a very unusual thing for a working-class childhood in Accrington, I think. So forever grateful to him for that.
Sounds very similar to my childhood, because I was born in Oldham.
Were in Oldham, Clayton.
I was born in Woodfield Maternity Home, which was a Catholic convent maternity home at the time. So I was born there in 59 and then raised in Shaw. First few years lived in Shaw, and then moved to Ayside and then Milne Row and then now Stopford.
just gone round M60 a bit.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, there wasn't even an M60.
No, of course there weren't, no.
I remember watching them build the M62 because I went to school in Middleton and they used to send us out on these 5 mile cross-country runs, which I used to hate. I used to hide in a drain under the canal and then wait for my mates to be coming back from Tandlehill Park or whatever and join in again. I'm nearly home, yeah. But I remember seeing the M62 getting built in the early 1970s on these cross-country runs.
Amazing.
And I always thought, that looks like hard work. I don't fancy doing that.
No, that's like working for a living, isn't it? Yeah. We both managed to get away with that.
During those teen years or those formative years, who were the musicians that inspired you, actors, comedians, what were the kind of characters that you focused on?
I suppose that what I always state as I think is quite key to who I am as a person is the first two albums I ever went and bought with my own money. Even Dave had been brilliant. So I remember, I think it was on my 11th birthday. He'll probably put me right on this. It could have been my 10th birthday. I remember I had a little group of friends around for a little party and he bought me Elvis Costello's Oliver's Army, and Blondie's Heart of Glass and David Bowie's Life on Mars, which were by a country mile the coolest records in my collection at that point. I had a little orange kind of like record player in my room. But the first two albums I bought were Wham! Fantastic! And the Smiths.
Brilliant.
And I bought them at the same time with my birthday money. Right. And the Smiths became a real massive, massive part of my life. Yeah. I mean, it became the total soundtrack to my teenage years in that little bedroom in church, like looking out over Reservoir. And
Because you'd be 15, 16, I guess, at the time.
Yeah, exactly.
And did you ever get to meet Morrissey?
I met him once. On an escalator at Kendall's,
right.
And he was so nice to me. I was in Corrie at the time, and I knew that he liked Corrie, but he was living in LA, so I didn't know whether he'd know who I were. So I had this like scramble, this mental scramble, thinking, does he really know who I am? Can I introduce myself? Anyway, I ended up just like double taking, waiting for him at the top of this escalator, and then as he came up, I just said, thank you. And he smiled and he said, I think you might have got me mixed up with somebody else. And I was like, oh. I'm thinking, have I? No, it is absolutely unmistakably Morrissey. And then he went up the next escalator and I stood at the bottom just watching him thinking, I've got to say something else, but I can't think of anything. And he turned around at the top and I just managed to say, all my life. And he smiled really kindly and went off, and he was like, he was very, very kind to me. He could have been very scornful of this like pathetic 20-odd-year-old boy. He was very nice.
He's on that phrase, somebody who doesn't suffer fools.
No, and I was absolutely a fool. So I was very grateful for him suffering me that day.
Let's talk about the getting into drama school. Did you have designs on getting into acting as a teenager, or was it like me? An excuse going to art school because I did so pathetic at grammar school. And when I left at the summer with no job to go to, somebody said, have you thought about art college? So I went to art college, not to become an artist, but just because it was one of the only options I had, having done so bad for the previous 5 years. So what was your drama story? How did you get into the drama thing?
Well, I think I was really, really lucky because I went to state schools, obviously. And I was dead lucky that at primary school, I had this ace teacher called Mrs. Mulderig who got us into doing like elocution exams, obviously very successfully, as you can tell. and basically, it was just about public speaking and saying poems out loud and doing little scenes. And I loved it. I absolutely loved it. And I found that I was really good at it and really confident. And she really, really encouraged me and nurtured me. I mean, it was not in my family at all. And so that carried on. I used to love writing and still like writing, but that was my main thing. Then I went to secondary school and again had some brilliant teachers who were really, really encouraging. You know, it's often down to that, isn't it? Just having like a couple of good teachers who just go like, you've got something in you. Look, do it. Just do it. Yeah. And then really, really crucially, as well as doing a bit of like local am drama as well, which I always forget to mention. It was like a massive part of my life, actually. But I went to a really, really good further education college, Accrington and Rosendale College. And we had a brilliant and inspirational teacher there, Martin Cosgriff, who'd been a working actor himself. And he just made us all feel like, I mean, I think we were doing it because we just enjoyed it. Do you know what I mean? And because we weren't very good at anything else. I did like theatre studies and film studies and dropped English. It was too hard. And and he was just, and I think he was just like, well, you can be actors. I was an actor. Go and do it. Give it a go. You might as well. So he encouraged us all to audition for drama schools. None of us thought we had a chance. You know, we didn't think it would be the likes of us, basically. And amazingly, loads of us got into drama schools all over the country. I mean, there were five of us at my drama school, Lambda, which is like a really posh drama school in London, Earls Court at the time. And there were five of us from Accrington there at the same time, which is completely disproportional.
Do you not think that? Because I'm, again, being from Oldham and being aware of what the Oldham Coliseum.
Oh, yeah, and Oldham Theatre Workshop as well, yeah.
Is it a big thing? Is it a regional thing? I mean, do we have more, a bigger concentration of these kind of facilities to teach young people acting? Is it a bigger thing up here than it would be in other parts of the country?
I don't know. What I do know is that it's being eroded, you know, that further education colleges are being cut back almost to the, you know, point where they're they're non-existent. You know, it's really, really hard now for further education. I know people who are teaching them now, and it's getting more and more difficult. It's getting more and more academic. So kids who, you know, that's sparking them, who have the practical side of it absolutely nailed, but were never great at the academic stuff. Mm-hmm. They're lost souls now in it. Right. We've got a government that's telling us that, you know, it's unrealistic to, you know, want to have a career or a life in the arts or culture. You know, even though cultural industries are absolutely thriving, you know, as opposed to most other industries in country. Yeah. So I think it's really hard now. And really crucially as well, Clint, you know, me and my mates all got full grants to go to drama school. So I had to go and like audition at Preston Town Hall to like some civil servants, do me drama school, or do me Lady Macbeth in his office. But I got a full grant and a full maintenance grant to go. And I feel so terrible that that's been taken away for young people now, because there's absolutely no way that I would have been able to afford to go, you know, then. Mm. I mean, people find a way because people are amazing, but, you know, it's an extra hardship. And also I was able to stay in London after drama school and sign on. You know, I'm one of them that I'm like state sponsored in terms of that. I was on Dole and claiming housing benefit for years, you know, like just messing around, building a theatre, running a theatre company, you know, unpaid with mates, doing a little bit of bar work on the side, bit of cleaning, you know, and it was like, and it was that and living with mates that was really as much a part of drama school as like as making me the person I am today, you know, and that freedom. I mean, Jarvis Cocker's talked about it before, you know, about that those dolly years where, you know, we could just like mess around with some mates and like make up some tunes, write some poems, and then, you know, he ends up being Jarvis Cocker. Yeah. Don't know whether that'd be possible now.
What about your first paid job, the first time that you did your performance somewhere and then somebody came up and said, hey, Julie, you're good at that, there's 20 quid or whatever. Oh, what was your first paid job?
My first paid job was at Royal Exchange in Manchester, which was a theatre that I used to be taken to with school and with college and with a friend of my dad's who lived in Middleton who used to take us to theatre all the time as well. So it was always my dream. So I played a little part, but it was after the bomb, so it was in 1997. So it was at Castlefield in a big marquee in Castlefield Market then because of Royal Exchange.
Yeah, they moved it, didn't they? I forgot about that.
Yeah, they had to while they rebuilt it. So it's typical that like I managed to get into the Royal Exchange and it wasn't actually in the Royal Exchange, it was in a tent. But and I was playing two tiny, tiny parts, just I would play the night watchman and a maid. But that's the first time where I could just relax. I lived with my mum and dad in Aki. My mate Joe, who's also from Aki, lived with his mum and dad while we were doing it. And he'd drive us to Bowkervale. We'd get tram in every day. And that was the first time. And then from that, I got... No, that's not true. That's not the first... No, I got a telly before that. Yeah. I did a Catherine Cookson miniseries. Yeah, that was the first time I'd actually been given money for acting. I'd done fringe stuff unpaid before that. And that was amazing because that felt like massive money at the time. Put up in a posh hotel in like Newcastle as well. It was brilliant.
It's amazing, isn't it? When the thing that you've loved doing since being a child suddenly becomes your income. It's like, I can't believe people today pay me for doing... DJing in clubs that I used to do for nothing because I wanted to do it. Being on the radio, people pay me for it. But I started doing it because I wanted to talk on the radio and play tunes and being in a flipping band, so the people throwing money at you.
And... I know. And isn't it brilliant? It's like sometimes I still like fight guilt about it because I enjoy it too much and I feel like, you know, it's kind of in me that it's like a hobby.
Yeah. Like, you were good. One of the great things about you is, like a lot of the other guests we've had on the podcast, you're good at giving back and putting something back into it all, aren't you? That's one of the things that really stands out about you.
Well, I don't know. That's a very nice thing to say. I mean, I feel like I feel like you have to a bit. You know, like what I say about feeling really, really bad for the next generation coming through who don't have all the privileges that I had. And when I say privileges, I don't mean in terms of like growing up wealthy or anything like that or going to a posh school. I mean that the state was just like holding me and nurturing me and encouraging me to do what I wanted to do. And I feel like we let that slide, our generation. We just kind of let that go. And I was the dog end of the generation who had all those things in place. And I feel like maybe part of what I try to do, I'm not always successfully, is like pay a bit back because of that, you know, because I do feel like I grew up in massive privilege in that way.
Let's talk about the character that completely transformed your career in 1998 when you got the job on Corrie playing Hayley Cropper. At that time, that's like 20 years ago.
Yeah.
First time there'd ever been a transgender character in a British TV series or soap opera. Yeah. Proper groundbreaking, that, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Was that for you as an actress? Was it a dream job being handed on a plate, or was it like this massive challenge that was a bit daunting to know that?
It was a complete dream job. I mean, to a ridiculous degree. I mean, you know, Clint, you know how much curry means to people up here. You know, it's
religion,
same in Oldham. It is. And it is in Aki as well. And like, you know, I've always said, like, I could have been like at Royal Shakespeare Company at National Theatre and people would be like, very nice, but when are we going to see you on curry? So part of it was a complete relief that I could finally be like, next Wednesday night, 7:30, you can see me on curry then. But also, and this always sounds like a lie because it's so ridiculous, but I'd written down like a list of things that I wanted a couple of years before I got it. And when I was still like, you know, a jobbing actor, not working very much, struggling, living in London. And I'd written three things on it. I'd written a new hat to be 200 quid in credit, unheard of. And to get a part in a soap that had something to say about the world that might change things. Never in a million years thought it would be curry because it never was. Do you know, it were like Brookie and EastEnders that used to do the big issues and everything. I love all that. I'm so like horribly right on. I loved all that. So I was just like, I'd love to do that. I'd love to be like whatever version of like Colin in EastEnders or Beth in Brookside, do something that shifts like public perceptions about something. Mm. I couldn't have dreamt that this would have come up. So when I got the audition for curry, all they told me about her was that she was called Hayley and she was fun. So in my head, I was like the new Bette Lynch. So I went in a leopard skin coat, red lippy, blonde hair, went in and the casting director like shuffled me into office and was quite sort of like, quite embarrassed about having to tell me about it, but said, this is the role, this is what it entails. What I didn't know at the time is that actually it was a bit of a joke, that it was just she was going to be one of like a series of disastrous dates for Roy Cropper. I didn't know that, and I certainly was never going to play it like that. So I went to Frontline Books in Manchester. Do you remember Frontline Books? Yeah. That big political bookshop, and got like as many books as I could on transgender and transgender issues, read up on it, went back, met the producer, had a little chat with him, read about five lines, and then got the part. They never saw anybody else for it. I mean, these days you've got to have got like a CV like Maureen Lipman's. You've got to be able to tap dance, play an instrument. You know, I've got to do about 17 auditions, chemistry tests. I mean, they just like got me in and just on faith, really. They'd seen me in the play at Royal Exchange. They'd seen me in Much Ado About Nothing. So when I got it, I was absolutely thrilled. It was a dream come true. And I had absolutely no fear about feeling that I was the person who could like represent this group of people properly and that I'd take it seriously. And I do. I was only 27. You know, I was like really, really young. And my dad, of course, was just like over the moon that I was in curry, but we're like, oh, Jew, why couldn't you just get a normal part? You were terrified that we were going to get loads of stick for it. But at first, people, it took a little bit of time for people to get used to it. The transgender community and like the pressure groups within it were very, very kind of watchful of it and didn't want it to be treated as a joke. It were different times, you know. And they were, you know, a little bit upset that they'd cast me, who isn't trans, in that role. But I still to this day maintain that it would have been unbearable pressure to be in that show at that time if you were actually transgender, because it would have been a terrible, there would have been so much press intrusion and it would have been too much, I think.
Yeah.
So it was just at the right time. And when I left, I think it was just the time when she would have become a bit of an anachronism. You know, it would have been a bit, I think people would have been like, well, why is she playing a trans character? Because now I don't think that would be done. So it worked out absolutely perfectly. And I'm so proud of what Corey did with that character. Yeah. Accidentally, because it just happened to be that people really took to Ryan early. But because of their relationship, we got thanked in Parliament. It moved the law forward. You know, the Gender Recognition Act came through in 2004. We were mentioned specifically in that. Because you can change the world by being in someone's living room three Absolutely. Or four times a week. You know, if you get to know someone, as you do with characters in Corrie, and get to like them and root for them, then the issues become secondary, and that's how you fight prejudice.
Amazing. You must miss that. I bet you'd love to be playing that part again, wouldn't you, sometime?
Yeah, well, I do. I think about it. It's funny because I've had such a full and lovely time since I left, so it's not like I mourn for it or grieve it at all. But I think about Hayley and I've got and she's sort of part of me but separate from me, and it's like I have this weird relationship with it. So when I'm watching, because my husband writes it now, which is brilliant, so I've got like a way in, I can like get all gossip, except I don't, because he doesn't tell me anything, he's right tight. I used to tell him everything. But I can like watch it now, and if she's mentioned, I get a proper like thrill. I'm like, oh, she's still there in the hearts and minds, you know. It's like I'll always be part of it, I think. And that's a really lovely feeling.
Let's talk about another a young lady that became a big part of your life. I'm talking about Sophie Lancaster. This is she was 20 when she got attacked with her boyfriend Robert in 2007 in your pretty much your hometown, Accrington, Bacup area.
Yeah.
And she was attacked by a bunch of teenagers, basically because of the way she and Robert were dressed. They were goths, weren't they? Yeah. We all know the story. Subsequently, you become the patron or a patron for the Sophie Lancaster Foundation. And you've actually ended up playing Sophie's mum, Sylvia, on stage and on TV.
Yeah.
Tell us how all that came about. I mean, I know there's obviously a regional connection. Did you know the family before this happened? No,
no, I didn't. I didn't know them. And it actually came about because I had two chance meetings with Kate Comby, who's the sort of the social media. She does all the publicity for him. She's absolutely brilliant. She's a really great friend of Sylvia and the family. And I had two chance meetings with her, one just before the trial, I think, and then one a little bit of time afterwards. And she gave me a wristband, you know, the sort of iconic Sophie wristbands, yeah, both times. And but the second time I met her, I'd had this random thought, and me and my husband had thought we want to do something, and we wanted to create like a writing competition for young people. That's what we thought. And we thought we'd do it in Sophie's memory and do it as a way of spreading awareness about Sophie Lancaster Foundation's campaign, and also to encourage young people in state schools in Greater Manchester to write. So we were thinking about it and we were planning it, and then I bumped into Kate again. And so I was like, I can't believe I've bumped into you. I'm so glad I've seen you. We've been having this idea. So the first time I worked with them was on that, and we created this big writing competition and did a big evening at the end of it at the Contact. And just about that same time, the radio play of Black Roses had come out, which was... If people haven't heard it, I really urge them to try and get hold of it. It was an afternoon play, and it was interviews with Sylvia, actual interviews with Sylvia the mum, interspersed with poems by Simon Armitage, written as if they were spoken by Sophie. So Rachel Austin, a brilliant actor, played Sophie, and it was one of those afternoon plays that you hear about now and again, where truck drivers are kind of pulling over at side of roads because it's so upsetting and moving, and absolutely, you know. It really, really did an amazing job of telling a story of Sophie and Sylvia from Sophie's birth, really, right through until her death. It was massive success, and Simon and Sue, his partner, who's a producer, wanted to make it into a theatre piece. And Sylvia said that she wanted me to play her in that. So to speak her words that had been on the radio, but verbatim, as if she was saying them in theatre. So I was still in Corrie at the time. And that was just a massive honour to be asked to do that. I was absolutely terrified because I hadn't done any theatre for years and years, and I were pretty much coasting in Corrie, you know, having a nice time, just like bobbing in, doing a few lines, coming home. And so I took time off to do that. And actually, it was doing that play that that really started me on the road to leaving Corrie, because I realised that, you know, actually there were other things I wanted to do and other stories I wanted to tell, and you know, it was pretty life-changing for me as well.
Not just other gigs, it's other stuff that's going to make the world better, and doing what you did with the Sophie Foundation is like brought a lot of awareness again, you know. And you mentioned about playing Sophie's mum. I reckon on stage playing that part in front of Sylvia probably on at least one night, I'm guessing, would have been probably the toughest gig you've ever had.
Yeah, well, she never watched it, actually. She watched the film eventually when we filmed it for BBC, but she never watched it. And I was really glad of that, because it was a bit too raw, really. I mean, people were desperately upset. I mean, there were, you know, most nights after we finished, me and Rachel, there were no applause. And we never went on for a bow or anything. People just sat in silence and didn't leave the theatre for a good 5-10 minutes, you know. It's like, it's a peg, you know, making it sound like, because we were so brilliant, it's the words, you know, it was the writing of it. It was just absolutely brilliant. And Sylvia's words. And, you know, and people would often say afterwards, oh, you know, it must be really hard to play that part and put yourself through that journey of what she went through every night. But honestly, Clint, I'd come off stage, I'd come back into the bar, and every single night, Sylvia and Kate and other people from Foundation would be in the bar selling merchandise, selling the wristbands and T-shirts and stuff. And I just thought, this is what it is. Do you know what I mean? It's like, how much of a complete wanker would I be to come off stage and to go into the bar and be like, yeah, it's really, really hard for me to play that part every night. It's really, because Sylvia's there doing it, getting up every morning, you know. after the most horrendous, horrendous thing has happened to her, for a child to be taken from her in such horrific circumstances, and like almost like the day after the trial, setting up that foundation and dedicating her life to changing things for other young people like Sophie and Rob. It's just like so inspiring. It's like, I do not know how people carry on after something like that's happened. And it's like, and that in itself was just completely, it was life changing, because you're just like, you know, acting, you put yourself into it, blah, blah, blah. But, you know, you're not living it. You're not living it.
And as with the Ailie Cropper storyline, what you did with the Sophie Foundation, just raised a lot more awareness and positivity towards, you know, minorities, whether it be popular culture to do with fashion, makeup, whatever, i.e. the goths. Or
people don't realise how much prejudice there is against punks and goths, you know, how many attacks, physical attacks there are on people.
It's still rife in our community. It's like, then professional footballers get it for being the wrong colour in people's minds. It's like, it's happening all the time. And, I admire you for, well, we all admire you for doing what you do, but when you choose these platforms to work from and make the world a bit better.
Well, I'm dead lucky.
Brings me nicely to politics as well. You've always been a keen Labour supporter. Did that start up? I mean, you said your mum and dad weren't very political when you were growing up.
No, but they were Labour supporters always. But no, they weren't the people who'd go out campaigning or even talk about it. You know, they still don't really. You know, my mum's amazing. I lost my dad a few years ago, but my mum looks like a typical little old lady in her sort of pastel, I might suspend his top with her hairdo and everything. She's like 80 odd now, but she's a firebrand. I'm not joking. She's just like, she absolutely knows everything that is going on. And she's quite out of step with all her friends and all the people she hangs out with. But she's like, she's brilliant. She's like, she's really, really great. But no, I think that me and my brother, I think Dave's political awakening came from punk, you know. I think it absolutely came from that. And he was a massive influence on me. I mean, I remember Thatcher getting in when I was 9 and being like, oh, it's good, isn't it, that a woman's in charge, and him putting me right.
I think that was the only positive thing about that era.
I don't think it outweighed the negatives, but it's carried on from there. And you know, I fell out of love with Labour Party for all the years when they weren't what I thought they should be or wanted them to be. And I'm sort of back in love with them again now, really, because I feel like they, well, it's just really simple for me. It's, you know, you can get all bogged down in detail, but I just feel like to make a fairer world, you've got to tax people with loads of money and spread it out and share it out evenly. And that's my philosophy, you know. And
it's quite a simple one, that, isn't it? Let's talk some more about your career. So you've been on stage and screen now for what, 25, getting on for 30 years?
Yeah. 20 more probably.
Who've been your favourite people to work alongside?
Well, I loved working with Rachel on Black Roses. That was really amazing, because we didn't just do it at the Royal Exchange. We took it on tour to sort of deprived areas in West Cumbria after we did that. And that was one of the most amazing experiences in my life. It was just after I'd left Corrie. So, because we did it again and then took it on tour. And I remember doing it in this little community centre in a council estate in Cumbria. And all these lovely, lovely people coming out to watch. And the ceiling was too low to put our lights. And we had chip butties beforehand that they bought for us. And we all sat around chatting. And then we did the play. And just being in this completely strip-lit room, watching all these people listen to the story, fall in love with Sophie and lose her, you know, in the like space of 45 minutes. It was just absolutely amazing. And both me and Rachel, that's bound us together forever, really. All my Corrie mates, David Nielsen, who played Roy, was just a joy to work with. But all of them, all my factory girls, Anthony, it was just a lovely place to work with Corrie. But everything I've done, I've worked with Geordie Whittaker on Broadchurch and then just on Doctor Who, and she is absolutely top woman. She's brilliant. You should try and get her.
Have a word, tell you, have a word.
Oh, she's hilarious, honestly. She's a brilliant person.
That'd be amazing. Out of all your career moments, what would be the one that, if you had to be judged by one, if it's that episode of News at 10 when you shuffled off this place and they show one little clip of you, what would it be? Would it be Ailie? Would it be Sophie? Would it be something else?
Well, you know, it's funny, isn't it? Because I've always said, I read this thing with an interview with Mike Hamill years ago, and he said, like, no matter what he does with his life, he knows that his obituary picture will be him as Luke Skywalker. And I think when you play a certain role, you just have to accept that. So it's like, even now, you know, I'm like, I like under my breath mutter my full CV to people who are like, are you Hayley? I'm like, yeah, but I was also in Broadchurch, Happy Valley and Doctor Who last week. Because I'm always just like, let me move on. But I know, I think it will always be Hayley.
Yeah.
But you know, I run a little theatre company in Manchester now called Take Back, and we like do immediate responses to social and political events, which sounds a bit dry, but it's not. The brilliant evenings, like short pieces, sometimes really funny, sometimes really moving. And what we've done is created a little community in Manchester. A little tribe, really, of like-minded people. And I think you could say, oh, well, you're just preaching to choir, you know, you're all like-minded, you're all kind of like, you know, feel similarly, you know, there might be a few differences along the way. But what I think's happening at the moment is that there's a lot of emboldening of, like, the racists and the right. And I feel like there's people in massive, you know, power, like Trump, who are giving people a voice and giving them a lot of sort of confidence in their really, really dodgy views, I think. And what we've just managed to do, just in Manchester, we've got this little team of people together and we have these evenings and it emboldens us and it gives us a bit of spirit and a bit of hope. And I think right alongside Corrie, I'm as proud of that as I am of anything, because we've got this little community of artists who are just like, just want to change the world in tiny little ways. Do you know what I mean? By telling stories. And that makes me dead proud. But I know that that won't be on the news at 10. It will be me and my red anorak, for sure.
Let's talk about Manchester a little bit. Do you feel that the city's got quite a unique and special spirit?
Oh, I really do. I'm so in love with this city. It's like... I wrote a book. I'm not shoehorning this in. I wrote a book. I got asked to write a book about my working diary for 2017. So it was over that year, and that obviously took in the you know, terrible events at the arena. It took in Manchester International Festival. It took in like everything that was going on culturally in Manchester at that time. And as I was writing it every day, I was just like, oh my God. I'm so in love with this city. It's like, because as I say, I didn't really grow up with it. I came in, I used to go to theatre with school. I used to come into Irondale. There was a bus that went from Accrington right outside Irondale and we'd do a bit of shopping there and get a bus, go straight back. So it wasn't like I was like ever really ensconced in it as a teenager. I was a bit too far out where I were. And then I lived in London all the way through my 20s. It's only when I got Corrie that I kind of moved back up here and fell in love with someone and moved in. And even up until recently, we'd always talk about, oh, maybe we'll go back to London, you know, when we're older, when the kids have left, maybe we'll just get like a little place somewhere a bit central, you know, blah, blah. And only a few weeks ago, I said to my husband, we're never going to move back to London, are we? And he went, do you not think? I said, oh, hell. I said, we're such Manx now. It's like, I love this city. It's like in the bones of me now. It's just, I think culturally, musically, politically, just in terms of the people and the friendliness, the way that this city mobilised and galvanised after the arena and just the love that was shown then. I just think it's an extraordinary place.
You know what it is, though? It's a sum of its parts, isn't it? Because you've got, like, you from Accrington, I'm from Oldham. We've got these other beautiful working-class communities in places like Rochdale and Middleton and the suburbs.
Yeah.
And combined, the centre of that could only be a beautiful thing, couldn't it?
Yeah.
And that's what I think Manchester is.
I think
represents.
So. And it adopts us. You know, it's like, it's that really came out, didn't it? You know, with Tony's poem afterwards and everything, that it's like, it's not a place that you even need to be born to. You know, to be a Manc, you know, you just become it. Yeah. You know, there becomes a point where you're just like, oh, I'm a Manc. I'm like, properly, you know, I'm a Lancashire lass and always proud of that. But yeah. Like, there's a bit of me now that is for every Manchester. Yeah. I'll just never be able to shake that off. I want to live here for the rest of my life.
If I was to ask you, who are your favourite humans of Manchester ever? Who would they be, past or present?
Okay, this is really, really hard. Okay, I'm going to say, I said, it's really difficult because I have these wristbands on my wrist that I always have on, even when I'm in like posh dresses and stuff. one of them is for Sophie, and so that is for Sylvia, who I think is an extraordinary person and has done incredible things for this city. One is for my friend Alex Williams, who died as, you know, complications from meningitis. And his mum, Alison, has set up a foundation in Tameside that helps people with disabilities to access sports and culture. And then Ruben's Retreat, which is another amazing charity in, you know, where I live, sort of in Glossop and in Tameside as well. Because Ruben died when he was two, and his mum has set up an amazing charity looking after people who, you know, have got poorly children in the family or have lost children. And so these three women, to me, are just constant examples of spirit and courage and about using something really, really terrible in their life to move forward and do something amazing and change the world and dedicate themselves completely into changing things for other people in a similar situation. And I think that any one of those three women would give it all up in a heartbeat to have their loved ones back. Mm. But they're making the most of what it is. So, and they're all greater Mancunians. So I have a long list because I feel really bad about not putting Lem on it, because Lem CC is like someone I absolutely love and adore. I love Tony Walsh, Louise Walwyn, who's a young curly-lever poet, activist. She's absolutely brilliant. There's so many, but I think it's going to be Sylvia, Alison and Nicola from Ruben's Retreat.
Perfect. Julie, before you go, describe Manchester in three words.
Gosh, it's so hard. Three words isn't enough. Okay, I'd say friendly, bonkers, alive.
Beautiful. Julie Esmond-Elsh, thank you for being a human of Excess Manchester.
Thank you, Clint.
That was Julie Esmond-Elsh. Make sure you join us next week, where I'll be speaking to Dave Mootree. Dave is the Chief Executive of Home Cinema and he's a Director of Culture for Manchester City Council. Don't forget to follow us on social media. We are at Humans Excess, and subscribe to Humans of Excess Manchester. Rate us. Feel free to leave us a comment if you fancy it. We love hearing your feedback. Thanks for listening. See you next week.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.